Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us, as always, on The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Rebecca Schwartzlos, author of Brainscapes, The Warped, Wondrous Maps Within Your Brain. Rebecca is a postdoctoral scholar researching brain development in the Department of Psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis. She was the editor of Trends in Cognitive Sciences for 3 years. And as she says in her bio, she likes to think about science and the universe on scales large and small. But most of all, she likes to think about thinking. I feel the same way, except for me, thinking about thinking kind of obviates the me for me to actually work. But by the way, Brainscapes was supported by a grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation Program in Public Understanding of Science and Technology. You know, they award almost $80 million in grants each year, including, obviously, NPR. So anyway, Brainscapes, we all know that we can see, hear, touch, smell, taste. Likewise, we are generally aware, sometimes I'm not, at least approximately where we are in space and in time. But have we ever really thought, where is the map that guides these senses and where each guide to each journey resides? So maybe today it's more of a GPS instead of those gas station maps they used to give away or the triptychs from AAA. Maybe we've also thought a little bit about our dog or our pig, say pig because I have one, and how they wander around and why their sense of smell and their ability to hear is more than we can comprehend. Well, so read Brainscapes and you'll get your answers. It's a very accessible manner and has a gentle sense of humor sprinkled throughout, which makes that comprehension so much more pleasant to obtain. I couldn't put Brainscapes down, which is a tough sell for a book about the universe within and without ourselves. And as you guys know, with an independent bookstore around my neck, kind of just kidding, kind of, it makes my job of selling so much easier, especially with such a great cover. So Rebecca, welcome and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sam. Thank you for the kind words about the book.
So why do you like cheese so much?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest in Chicago area, and you know, there we think everything's better with cheese.
Well, the reason I ask is because look at this. This is the guy I'm interviewing tomorrow. Whoops. Can you see this?
It disappears a little bit.
Oh yeah, because it's called A Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles. Mm. So it's kind of like a map too of cheeses throughout the UK. So I'm really excited about that.
That sounds fabulous.
I know. First question is, what's your favorite cheese? So the cover and the UK cover, both of them are really cool. And you can always tell when a publisher likes you when you get embossing, which you got on yours. So can you show it? Can you hold it up?
Yes, yeah. So here is the US version, which is looking backwards, I think, because of Zoom.
No, it's forward.
It's forwards. Okay. I guess it's flipping it for me. And yeah, that was such a surprise to open it up and feel the texture on here. I just wanted to run my fingertips over it. I think they, you know, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the publisher, did an amazing job of handling the book and helping me just put it together, and they made it so beautiful. So I'm very grateful for that. And then, yes, this is the UK version, which is, they tell me that in Britain, the Brits like their covers a lot more colorful. So this is is a very different look, but I really enjoyed both of them. Yeah.
The UK cover gives you a brain stem.
That's right. It is not excluding anything.
This is excluding part of your, well, no, it is. Never mind. So as we go through the book, I guess, in the beginning chapter, which basically is introducing an atlas of me and the map of that me. So what if you were mapping, say, with this cheese guy, the estuaries of Great Britain, and you look at the map and it's almost fractalized because it goes in and out and in and out. So what are the similarities, since you decided to call this and talk about it in terms of a map? What are the similarities and differences between those two tasks and their results?
Yes. So I talk a lot in the first chapter about how maps, when I use the word maps, we all think of the maps that we use to navigate around in space. So we sort of automatically think that a map is something that represents space around us that we, you know, kind of geographic space that we can move about in and that we need to orient ourselves with respect to. But there's a broader definition of the word map, and that broader definition is a spatial representation of something. And it doesn't have to be space on the earth. It could be, you know, stars in the sky, but it could also be other aspects of our world that can be kind of placed in a spatial orientation and represented in that way. And so in that kind of meaning of the word map, we are, our brains are just chock full of them. And they are similar in some ways to geographic maps, but different. And in fact, one of the things I don't get to talk a lot about, I had to trim down in a way, was that, interestingly enough, one of the things that our brain doesn't represent with maps is geographic location. So that is something that is represented through what's called neural codes, which is kind of a complementary way in which the brain represents information. And between codes and maps, we kind of have everything covered with this little bit of brain space that we hold on to.
Yeah, everything kind of tees off, because then you could talk about your spatial referential guide, which, you know, revolves so much around your ears, which we don't even, you know, I can't go off as I usually do, because I have actual pertinent questions, because the chapters are so well named. So it's a lot easier to go through things. So if I was going to ask the next question, it goes to the concept of tyranny of numbers, because I've always been interested in that, because I remember, I think you're too young, but there was the Cray 1 computer. It was this beautiful, aesthetically, incredibly pleasing computer, but it had 500 miles of wire. And they finally decided that they couldn't do anymore because most of the components of the computer would be solder. So talk about how that works with us.
Yeah, so I open the second chapter with this description of a story that seems unrelated about Bell Labs and the discovery that as engineers were learning how to put together computers and machines that did things in the early days, they were hitting upon this consistent problem, which is, as you said, you know, in order to connect all the different components within a complicated machine, you wind up having so many wires that it becomes impractical. Incredibly so. And in fact, what I explain is that our brain is under the same constraints, that our brain is like, you know, it's a, what it really is these billions of neurons and other supporting cells, and the neurons have to connect with one another in order to communicate and represent and process information. And those wires, they take up space. I mean, they're called axons, but those connections between those neurons take up space and they take up a lot of energy. So in order to make, you know, this device that we have here and to make it practical and to make sure that we don't starve it just so that we can support our own ability to perceive things, evolution has hit upon this remarkable solution of generating maps within the brain. And these maps allow you to put all the things that need to talk to each other, you know, as close as possible, not all things, but you try to make it so things that need to talk together are close. And therefore, you wind up actually creating these literal maps of your senses, of what you see, of what you feel, what you hear, of the space around you and the objects in them, in the surfaces and tissues of your brain. They're represented there, and that's because of those physical constraints for survival.
What was kind of scary about it was when you talk about like taking a pencil, well, not here, well, maybe here, but on your knee, and you just touch this one point. And there's this guy that says, oh, yeah, okay, I'm waking up now. He doesn't care whether you're scratching your back or someone's giving you a massage, but he just cares about that tiny, tiny point. And it's so hard to wrap your head, no pun intended. Well, actually, that's the way you're always doing it. It's so hard to wrap your head around the concept of so much of that going on. And the other, it's not really a metaphor, the other picture, oh yeah, there's great illustrations in this book that are very helpful in understanding, like the whiskers of a rat. And you feel like there's a receptor for each of those whiskers that gives the rat a really good idea of where he is in the sewer. And so you're talking about the tyranny of numbers. How can you justify that? How can you correlate those two and say, yeah, it works this way?
You mean how can we confirm that
How is it possible? You're talking about the tyranny in numbers, but then you make this point that every little tiny thing is connected to another little tiny thing.
Well, it's possible because there's quite a bit actually that's happening around us that we aren't even perceiving or aware of. So it's possible because in a sense, our neural architecture and our kind of the periphery, our bodies themselves are specialized to process different types of information in different parts of our bodies and to specialize on processing some things and not others. You know, so you have your eyes at the front of your head and there's nothing to see in the back. You just sort of give up on what's back there, right? And likewise, we have fingertips that are far more sensitive. There's more touch receptors in the skin of our fingertips. And then in our brain, where we have a map of the touch on the surfaces of our body, that area is further magnified to preserve all the little detail from the fingertips. And things like, you know, what happens on the back of your, on your back or on your arm is kind of some of that information is lost. And that's why, you know, that shapes our behavior, because we know, you know, if I want to touch something, I better use the place that's best on my hand for touch. So we don't even realize in some ways how bad we are at seeing out of the corner of our eyes or feeling with our backs, because we don't do those things.
And then the corollary of that is that one diagram that we've all seen since we were little kids of the mouth being gigantic, you know, and the hands being gigantic. And it was so familiar seeing that. And then you do it for the other animals, the rat and the pig. And I was thinking of, did you ever read The Once and Future King by T.H. White?
I think in high school.
Because it's Merlin's like playing around with Arthur. He calls him Wart, and he transforms him into a fish and then a hawk and then an ant and then a goose and a badger. And he gets to do, and you even say it in your book, you say, imagine if you imagine this is what it would be. And that's what he gets to do. And yeah, you almost do that, which is really hard to do. I thought that was really good.
Well, thank you. You know, I've thought a lot about this because, as I mentioned in another chapter about smell, my mother didn't have a sense of smell. And so I thought a lot about, you know, as a kid, even like, how do you, you know, I want to describe what smell is to my mom, and she's never experienced this sense since she was born. So how do you imagine something that you've never experienced? And it actually kind of came full circle, because as I talk about in a later chapter, when we imagine things, we are very much harnessing these maps that we also use to perceive the world. So, you know, the same maps that allow me to feel something touch my hand allow me to close my eyes and imagine something touching my hand. And that's why when you create mental imagery, it feels so much like actual sensation, because you're harnessing some of the same architecture to make that happen. And it also helps explain why it's so darn hard to imagine something you've never perceived, because you don't have the neural architecture to represent, for example, a totally new body part that you don't have, or, you know, vision from the back of your head, or, you know, if you've never smelled. So I think, so to me, I had to think about, you know, what would it feel like for a pig, and how can we then, we have to find a way to translate that to what we can feel, because, you know, we don't have a snout like a pig, obviously, but we can think about how it would feel similar using our own body architecture and our own ability to perceive with that body and brain structure.
When you talk about deafness in certain frequencies or blindness, a lot about blindness, and it reminds me of this science fiction short story I read one time where this guy goes to an alien world and they have another sense. And you can, the way it's described, it's a beautiful sense. So he keeps asking them, let me have, they can give it away but only for an hour. And he keeps asking, and they go, no, you really don't want to do this. But they give it, he begs them and they give him the sense for an hour. And it's so beautiful and sublime that he's like, so blissful, but then they take it away after the hour, and the rest of his life, he does nothing but mourn the fact that he no longer has that sense. So ignorance is bliss, I think.
I could see that. And it's interesting to try to think about, you know, what would it be like to have a different sense that we don't have? And I talk a little bit about in the book, I had to, again, cut some things, but there are lots of animals who do have senses that we don't have. And you know, that is another kind of mind-bending experience to sort of imagine and think that in some ways these creatures around us have their own superpowers, their own sensations that we are incapable of feeling because of the way that our own bodies and brains have specialized for our existence.
Yeah, yesterday I talked to this woman who wrote a book about bees, and you think of the behavior of bees and how they communicate. And, you know, everybody, you know, lots of books to try to explain it, but it's almost impossible to explain how they communicate and the bee dance and creating heat or keep cooling off the hive, things like that. Yeah, you can't possibly understand, but I'm rambling like I always do. So that also, what you've been saying also goes back to that old cliche that what I perceive as green is not necessarily what you perceive as green either. And I know we've all talked about that, but that's something that I never really thought about when I read your book, because I don't know if you actually, did you address that? The concept of, you know, different, you did a little bit about different.
I mean, not exactly. So I don't talk so much about color and sort of labels as well. So there is this whole other way in which language interacts with perception and how, you know, what I call green, I might experience as something different. That has, you know, both kind of a neural aspect to it and sort of a linguistic aspect to it and almost a philosophical aspect to it. So I don't really get into that, but I do think about like how our perception of the world in terms of what's called acuity, kind of like the fine details that you can make out through your sense of touch or visually. Those details can be the layout of the map, like how exactly it's warped, how it gets stretched for the sweet spots and to what degree will shape how well you can feel or how well you can see. And those idiosyncrasies can be pretty different between, for example, you and me. So that, you know, even aside from whether our eyes are 20/20 or not, the way that our brain exactly stretches the information coming in from the eyes in the visual maps can be slightly different as well. And that can affect what we perceive and how much detail we can perceive.
Yeah, and as you said, it's not only philosophical, it becomes kind of metaphysical. Can I ramble for one more second?
Please.
Okay, so in the past couple of months, I've interviewed Frank Wilczek he wrote a book called Fundamentals. He's a Nobel Prize winner. And then Math Without Numbers, and then 7.5 Lessons About the Brain by Lisa Feldman, and Galileo's Error by Philip Goth, and The Case Against Reality by Donald Hoffman, and Rethinking Consciousness. And I've gotten all those authors really pissed off. And the reason I get them pissed off is because I say, what about solipsism? Which of course means that only one of us is here. But they all get upset because you all have your own theories that you really like. And it's not convenient at all to think about the possibility of solipsism. Not that we would do anything different, but have you ever thought, well, yeah, you think about thinking. So you've thought about that.
So that is a very philosophical, excellent question. And I guess to some degree, we have to acknowledge that we have limited information in many different ways about our existence. And we have to, even those of us who, you know, are not scientists, we need to all kind of in our own way venture our educated guesses about what we think is happening, you know, and scales great and small. So I think, you know, part of that is that you know, in science and in existence, there are things that are hard to rule out and maybe not impossible, but also, you know, a lot of us in science, we like to think about what is the most likely solution or what is the most the explanation that, you know, has the most support or the most evidence. And so I think that's part of why scientists, you know, would avoid that particular explanation. But it is a fun thought experiment.
Yeah, I think about it a lot. And that's because I'm narcissistic. It's the other thing is I asked the fundamentals guy, Frank Wilczek, who's a mathematician and a physicist. I said, why isn't one a prime number? Because I've always thought about that. It's divisible by itself, but it's also divisible by one. The question is one different than the essence of what it is? And he goes, because it wouldn't be convenient.
Well, and in I was going to add, actually, in our universe, it wouldn't be convenient yet, but also like in our universe, convenience and sort of energy efficiency is such a driving force. So unless you are imagining that as well, assuming that, you know, the intricate and the complex and the energy burning things that we do need to be, we need to have a reason for them, right? That they have to be supported by things, and we have to, therefore, that nothing like comes for free, at least in the universe as we know it. So having this fantastical experience in your brain or in your singular mind would be very energy inefficient.
That's a good one. But you talk about energy a lot and how much this thing uses up. I mean, a good proportion of what we're taking in is used up by these billions of connections.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that we take our mind at face value. This is what being conscious is like, but it is so intricately shaped at every level by being parsimonious and being, you know, being very careful about how energy is used and how space is used so that we can survive. And so like everything that we do, it has to have a benefit for us. I mean, everything that our brain, all the architecture there has to really be worth it. Because, you know, up until recently, it was very easy to starve to death, you know, and I mean, it still unfortunately is in place. I mean, staying alive is hard. And so the architecture that we have is just beautifully suited because of time, because of experience, because of many, many other people who've perished to allow us to survive and eke the most out of what little brain space we have.
Yeah, and that goes to another thing, which I've often thought about, is, you know, you talk a little bit about imagination, and then I guess if we're going to move along, imagination, communication, understanding, the concept of a portal, and those are things that, again, go to my science fiction mind, and especially like, and then I compare it to dreams, like the weird dreams I had last night. And I woke up this morning and I'm thinking to myself, like you might do, is wait a minute, is that, maybe that was my reality. I'm just, and this interview is not. But so where does that reside? Where does all of that reside? There's no knee to touch. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are other areas of the brain, and especially these kinds of areas that kind of drive, sort of spark the experience of a memory that you bring to mind, or a dream, which sometimes can be kind of a combination of memories and sort of neural dynamics. These things are often sparked by parts of the brain that operate under these population codes, and that are very flexible. So instead of having kind of like a relationship so that two neurons next to each other are doing similar things, which is how maps work, in these areas, two neurons next to each other could be doing or representing pretty different things. And they sort of reach out and sort of spark through their pattern of connections. They spark patterns of activity throughout the rest of the brain that become instantiated as this is an experience of X or Y. And in doing so, they start pulling the brain maps into the mix. And that's, again, why when you generate mental imagery or dreams, you are using these perception maps, and you can even see that activity. If you were to scan somebody while they were having a dream or while they were imagining, you can see the activity in those maps that is reflecting that imagined or dreamed content. But the actual place where that kind of wacky dream begins is those are areas that are not maps, that are sort of more flexible and a bit more rogue.
Isn't it funny how you smile all the time and you laugh because it's like, you like this so much, you can't help it. I do that too. Isn't that weird? Look at you.
Yeah, I apologize. It makes me giddy. I mean, it's exciting. It's really, there's nothing more fun than thinking about why we are the way we are and what our experience is made of. So yeah, I get a little bit geeked out and excited.
It's nice. I don't take it for granted because you and I both have the luxury of being able to do that. You know,
yeah.
People don't.
Absolutely.
So I was reading this, wait a minute. Oh, darn it. I'm not bringing it down. So I can remember there was this article in The Atlantic the other day. Oh yeah. This one about neuroscientists have discovered a phenomenon they can't explain by Carl Schoonover and Andrew Fink. Mm-hmm. And they were doing this experiment with mice who they give them roses to smell. And then a month later, there's other neurons that are smelling them. And I immediately thought of you and I was going to say, hey, you're wrong.
Fair enough. So that, you know, and actually even in the book, there is sort of an allusion to that, which is that when you, so I talk near the end of the book about brain-computer interfaces or BCIs and how now we have the technology to actually have a computer interact with your brain map in either kind of inject sensation into it by manipulating activity in the map or reading information out of it. And one of the things that's been actually known for decades is that when you have something in the brain that's trying to read out, like say if you have somebody who's paraplegic and you put something in their motor cortex and you want to decode from their motor cortex what, you know, when to move a robotic arm, over time they have to keep recalibrating that system because something slightly changes about the representation. Now it's tricky because there's a lot of things that can change, and I think one of the things that it suggests to us, so there are static aspects to the map, but also there's a dynamic nature to the individual responses of neurons. And there's an incredibly powerful effect of context and learning. So that over time, you know, your brain, you know, this month is not exactly the same as it was last month because of all the things that you've done in between, right? And so if I stuck, you know, I keep an electrode in your brain in the same place, and then a month later, it's doing something slightly different, which is what they've been finding with these BCIs, right? It's a little bit different. It's still a motor area, but maybe the exact signals aren't meaning exactly the same thing. That is like, that can be a really fascinating way of thinking, like what, you know, first of all, you know, that you are changed and you are, your neural activity, even in like a visual map, is shaped by kind of what you know about your world. So there's like top-down information. But also, I think it's, what was I going to say about the other thing? So there's the top-down aspect to it. And there's also sort of the context. And, you know, I've forgotten the third point I wanted to make. I'm just too long-winded with the first two.
Why do you forget that? What in your brain makes you forget that?
Well, I talk about working memory in the book. Although working memory is more than just what I talk about in the book. It is very complex beast indeed. But yes, I would like to have the answer to that question.
I'll let you off the hook on that one. But to carry your analogy even further, what you just said sounds like almost like continental drift or tectonic plates or something like that. If that works. I mean, if that's what you're talking about, kind of.
You know, it's maybe what it's, I think is, and you reminded me now of the third point. So what it is what I wanted to say is that it also hints that the brain is far more dynamic and sort of not coding things exactly in the simplistic way that we kind of have to describe them. And this is a problem that we deal with in neuroscience all the time. So we generally have, especially with these areas that I described, these like very low level sensory errors, we generally have a pretty good idea. But you know, we're putting them into our framework. We put them to our words and say they represent X. But from the brain's perspective, that might not be kind of carving nature at its joints. That might not be quite the right description for exactly what and how it represents. So even though for our purposes, like we've well established that the visual map is primarily processing visual information affected by context, and this, you can manipulate it to make people see things. Nonetheless, you know, when you get deeper, there may be aspects of experience that it's representing that we have no idea about yet.
Now you made me forget what I was going to say.
Well, there you go.
So the other thing you talk about, well, you do talk about imagination. So we kind of did that a little bit. But so how do we determine, and you do, and this is a chapter, either, and kind of what you're talking about, either accurately or not, what is really going on? And then, like we're doing now, which is, again, going back to my silly solipsism, how do I accurately, and how are you accurately representing to me?
Yes.
Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah. So I try to make some inroads some inroads into that in the book. And I do talk about one thing that's been kind of beautifully studied in terms of communication and shared meaning, which is the work has shown that when you communicate something, you know, as I'm doing to you now, if you were to put me in a brain scan machine and you in a brain scan machine, you would see that what I am saying and what's happening in my brain, a lot of it is, you know, the same brain maps in somewhat similar kind of activation patterns are going to be reinstantiated in your brain a few seconds later as you process what I say and you kind of strip it down to the original meaning. And so there's a way in which you can think about sort of the accumulation of meaning in our shared experience in a physical world and our shared neural architecture that reflects our experience in this physical world that allows us to have this synchrony that you can actually see happening in the brain. And the more that we synchronize, the more that your brain activity looks like my brain activity after we have this conversation, the better you will remember what I said and the better you will comprehend what I said if you were tested.
And when I read that, I thought, oh, that's nice. But then I thought, we're living in a world that's so polarized, like with maskers and anti-maskers and vaccine and anti-vaccine. So there must be something stopping because people don't listen anymore. Whether you're talking about abortion, pro-choice, pro-life, there's something that stops them from listening, because if they listened and understood the other person's position, then they might be what I was going to, I was going to talk about plasticity. I mean, you'd be willing, if you listened, to allow yourself to alter the viewpoints that you previously held, but that's changed a lot. And so what does that mean?
So I am not a social psychologist, but there is an incredibly rich kind of and growing literature on how we have our attitudes and our affiliations, you know, what we call ourselves and who we think we believe and how we can discount what other people say almost before they've said it, right? And that's a whole fascinating sort of other higher level way in which we are filtering information that we receive. And like you said, I mean, I'm sure that if you're hearing information from somebody who you disagree with and what you're doing rather than listening is coming up with counter arguments, you're not going to have that same brain synchrony and you're not going to have that same comprehension. And you're probably not going to change your mind and agree with them in the end, or at least see their point of view, because you haven't really engaged in having that shared meaning with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll leave it alone. But it's like if you're listening to a QAnon person for some reason, it seems as if their brain is somehow different than yours, because your immediate response is, what the hell is wrong with them?
I think it's what's amazing is that I think what you surround yourself with, your environment shapes what is normal and seems acceptable and credible to you. And if you're in an environment where that is what everybody believes and that is what people that you respect tell you, then you will believe it as well. And I think that is like kind of one of the challenges that we have now, where we kind of don't have, we have such a, you know, in a wonderful way, a democratization of information, right? But we also, therefore, you can find whatever channel or whatever kind of source of information fits your desired upshot. And as a result, they're not getting exposure to the reality, or they don't trust the sources that are giving it to them.
Yeah. And that kind of like, it's not primal, but maybe it's like seminal. The idea, my first year of college, I went to this like, you know, really liberal college, and the curriculum the entire first year was nature versus nurture. So every class dealt with an aspect of nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
I think it's a little different. I think it's a kind of more on the social psychology level of having an attitude, having a belief, having affiliations and saying, these are my people. I trust these people. I don't trust those people. But
I'm trying to get you to stick it in a different part of their brain and you won't do it.
We all have the same brain. It's just the information that goes in and comes out that, you know, is different. And, you know, all of us are guilty of filtering information that we receive based on what we want to believe and what people that are close to us and that we think are part of our group believe. So that's something we could all work on.
Well, it's funny because when you talk about social psychology and all the work that's being done in it, that's what maybe when I was researching and looking at like abstracts about your work, how do you, okay, you write this book that, you know, it's popular science and everyone who comes into my bookstore is going to look at this cover and do that feeling thing. And they're going to pick up the book because I've said this 1,000 times, but anyone who says you can't judge a book by its covers, everyone who comes into my bookstore, that's what they do, no matter what you say. So I guess it's like, I don't know. It's like, what experimentally do you do that gets you to the point where you're able to communicate this in this fashion? It's like I'm saying, I'm looking at abstracts and I know someone, you know, who puts placer cells in mice to determine how memory is mediated by fear from the hippocampus to the cerebral cortex. And that's about as far as I can get. But what kind of stuff are you doing that gets you to this point?
So in terms of being able to communicate these ideas to a general audience,
I
love talking about this because I think that, first of all, we don't give scientists many opportunities to train in communicating to a general audience, even though it would behoove them and behoove society. But one of the things that I intentionally did was I went to my mom's book group and I went to the playground and talked to other parents who are just there. I tried to explain these ideas to people who've never heard of them before. And I kind of would gauge the things that they would be like, what's that? What are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. And it wasn't always what I at first intuitively would have guessed was challenging because I've been familiar with these ideas for a long time. And, you know, the people around me in science are familiar with these ideas. So that was incredibly helpful getting that first person experience of saying, you know, these are the concepts that need to be explained and here's why. And I also made a point of reading popular science books that are outside of my field, things like, you know, astrophysics books and biochemistry books and things that where I got to feel like the outsider who didn't know the jargon and didn't know the system very well and needed all that help. And it was really great because then I got to kind of observe from as the outsider what worked and what didn't, what aspects, what kind of techniques helped me have access to that expert knowledge, and then tried to employ that myself.
Okay. Here's a Terry Gross question, which I try to stay away from. But like, when did you start thinking like this? Were you like 8, 6, 5?
I was sort of a studious kid, and I was very introspective. So I was very interested in thinking about minds and behavior, but I didn't know that it was a thing I could study at that time. But even then I was like obsessed with writing. So I would write maybe poetry, I would write fiction, and I love to express through words. I love to devour books. And so I feel like that idea of communicating through the written word is sort of in my blood. I sort of always, from the time I was very young, had a kind of compulsion to need to do it. And then as I was exposed to neuroscience and psychology and was able to give words to these questions that I had been pondering on my own, the idea of marrying those two loves was pretty appealing.
Did you watch people? When you say you're introspective, but did you like say in the schoolyard at recess, did you kind of like watch?
I was an awkward kid. So yeah, I was often sitting by myself or, you know, sort of observing and thinking like, why am I by myself? You know, and how come they get along so well? And, you know, why are these people fighting? So I don't know. I was thinking more than interacting.
That's how I was. I used to go to sleep and that was so weird. I would go to sleep and I would think that while I was asleep, my parents would dismantle the universe because there was no point to having, I keep going back to solipsism. There was no point in having the universe exist if I wasn't there. So they dismantle it at night. And then right before I wake up, they would like put it back all together again. And that was like when I was 6 or something. So yeah, that's how I turned out so weird.
I love that. That's great.
It was like a lot of work, but that's the same work and energy that the brain's doing all the time.
Inefficient, yeah.
Well, all right. So like, this has been great, but in conclusion, you picked the word brainscape. So it's your word and you gotta, you know, you own it. So it immediately makes you think of landscape, which is what you're doing. But landscape is like, it's like a visible feature that we see of land and land forms and how they integrate with natural or stuff we do. And it's like, it's vital to your identity. And so it helps you develop your own self-image, a landscape in a sense, and differentiates you from other people. And it's kind of also dynamic. And you did touch on that, on the dynamic aspect of it. So why did you choose? What was it obvious to you that this was the analogy that you would use from the very beginning of the book? I guess it was, because it's that's what it is.
I knew that I mean, even, you know, in neuroscience, we call these areas topographic brain maps. So even in the scientific lingo, that analogy looms very large and kind of defines how we talk about these areas, that they are maps in their own sense, even though they're not the same as the map, you know, on your GPS display. But what I wanted to do is take it a step further and explore a little bit more about how these maps and the way that they kind of allow us to represent our world. And in addition, since they're warped, they are kind of, in a sense, they're sort of warping our representation of the world, right? They're generating, for example, a visual field that gives you this incredible acuity here, but just terrible, terrible acuity here, you know? And that's, you know, that's more because of your brain than because of your eyes. And so that is, you know, that we're living in that reality that is created and represented within the head. And I talk about how if you zap a part of the brain, you're going to see a light. If you zap a part of the visual map, you'll see a light, even though there isn't a light there. And if you damage a part of the visual map, you'll be blind there, even though your eyes work. So, you know, it's really that representation, those representations in the brain are what we live in and what we experience. And so I wanted to engage with the reality of those representations. So I gave them a name. I called them brainscapes, and these kind of representations that are created, that arise from these maps or occupy the maps, and that we use to make sense of our world. It's not exactly the same as a landscape, and I don't mean to sow confusion with it. I wanted to give a term for this idea, and you know, it's an idea that's kind of intrigued people for hundreds of years, and think a little bit about what those representations are like and how they shape our everyday experience.
Okay, well, that kind of leads to my last question then. So, you know, these guys who can recite pi to 10,000 numbers, digits. So do you have, not that I'm saying you're a savant, but you could be a savant, but I don't know whether you're a savant or not, but do you have in your head, it's hard to talk without using your own metaphors, but do you have in your head, like, do you see a picture? Do you see a picture of this?
Oh, this is a very philosophical question. And no, there is not, like, you know, the brain maps are not like a Cartesian theater. They're not like a movie that you're watching inside your brain. You know, I think rather than there's like a, they are helping you to construct the reality that you're in. So, I mean, it's more like, I guess, like, you know, you're a character in a video game and these brain maps are helping to create that video game, but it's not that you are, you know, you're literally seeing these maps and their representation. They are very influential in what you perceive, and you can render these maps visible and see what's in them, but they are not like something that we, in essence, are staring at and experiencing, like there's a little guy inside our brain looking at it, right? But you know, if you had to find a, you know, there are ways in which some of these maps are, they're not conscious perception involves a lot of the brain, a lot of things happening at once, right? So you can't just have one area that is carrying that whole load. But some of these brain maps, some of them are very influential for what we perceive. So, I mean, as close as you're going to get to finding an area that's going to, you could use to try to kind of see what someone is perceiving, these would be your best bet.
I keep
saying, that's a bit of a hedge question to answer, huh?
Well, anytime I get near philosophy, you kind of like back off a little bit, but that's because you're a scientist.
Well, you know, there are some amazing philosophers out there studying these things, and I want you to ask them. They're the qualified people to answer these questions.
And once again, another question I asked all these guys, and I do it, I guess part of me does it specifically to irritate them, but because I like doing that. But the other question is, like, I always say it this way, do you think there's a ghost in the machine?
I think the machine is the ghost. I think a lot of people think that having a brain that's just physical, that doesn't have a soul, that is depressing and sad and sort of dehumanizing and therefore can't be true. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, people believe what they do about a soul, but I think about the brain is that, and I hope that you can come away from this book feeling, is that the physical properties of the brain, you know, are amazing and in their own way miraculous, and they're enough, you know, and we don't fully understand how they're enough, but when you look under the hood, you can see the ways in which they can be enough. And when you also go the other direction and you look from psychology, you see the ways in which our conscious experience is not nearly as rich and continuous and logical and that as we think that it is, and we really are kind of crafting between this fabulous, efficient brain that's doing as much as it can, although it's still very limited, and this big wide world that it's trying to represent. We're finding this happy medium, and that you know, these amazing, the principles of representation allow us to do that.
My daughter asked me yesterday, she goes, I have a friend who says that animals don't have souls. Like my dog doesn't have a soul. And I said, well, I guess first we have to, one, figure out whether people have souls, and then secondly, go back and go, what is a soul? And you're not going to tell me what a soul is, are you?
I'm not. What I am going to say is that I wrote this book to talk about like the physical aspects of the brain that give rise to so much, and to try to help the reader understand, to the degree that we understand in the field, how, you know, many of the mechanisms that allow that to be. And what I felt is that in coming away from it, even though it's physical, it's all physical, it's all science, there's a spiritual kind of really broadening feature to it, that it's connecting, it's unifying, it's kind of remarkable. And so to me, I find that very uplifting. And I feel like, you know, for me, there's a soul in that machine, because that machine allows us to do what we do, and that it connects me to you and to everyone else. So for me, that's a big deal.
Me too. Because I always like to end when I feel like I've painted someone's kind of in a corner. I kind of did, because your friends are going to say, what were you saying about this soul? I don't know about that.
Well, you know, those are the deep questions that everyone comes to themselves. But for me, I just think there's a lot of beauty in what we can already see from the perspective of neuroscience.
Well, in terms of selling your book, which I don't know whether I'm good at it or not, the thing that's cool about it is it's like reading a novel where at the ending you're wondering what's going to happen to these characters, you know, like it's not wrapped up in a bow and you're going, I wonder if they're going to get married. I wonder if they're going to succeed at the business. I wonder if they're going to realize the error of their ways. This book kind of did that, because it makes you want to explore. And yeah, so that's why I'm picking it up and showing people as they enter. And again, my daughter, she's kind of a pain in the ass, but also behind the counter, she'll get out from behind the counter, go to the front table, grab your book and go, you have to buy this.
Oh.
And she's good at it.
Well, thanks to your daughter.
I'll tell her. Anyway, it was a pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, so much fun. Thank you, Sam. I enjoyed it too.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.